Go ahead, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Alan Sweep. I'm registration number 13491, and I represent Aspen at Streamside. Your Honors, in January of 2009, the appellee here, Highland PUD, acting through its board of managers and undisputedly without any vote of the owners, replaced an existing set of declarations with a document entitled Restated Declarations, or amended and restated declarations. The vote was 8-2. The two members dissenting were the two members that represented Aspen and Streamside. So the issue before this court, Your Honor, the same issue that was before the court at the trial court level, is whether Highland followed proper procedures and utilized the correct standard in taking the action that it took. Our opening brief sets forth a number of legal arguments. I'm going to try, obviously, in terms of my limited time, to focus just on two of those arguments. The first argument is one of the arguments raised in our brief, and that is whether the restated declarations was an amendment at all. If it's not an amendment, it's our position that the Board of Managers had no authority, had absolutely no authority whatsoever to adopt the restated declaration under any circumstances. As a side issue, Highland does argue in its answer brief that this issue was not raised below. We, in our reply brief, pointed out the number of places where, in fact, that issue was raised on page 6 of our reply brief, and I think it's fair, or certainly our position is that the issue has been preserved for appeal. So why is the restated declaration not an amendment? Well, I think the title of the document suggests that it's not an amendment. It's a completely new document. It's a completely new instrument. The initial document, the initial declarations which were replaced, is no longer in effect. It has been completely replaced by the new declarations.
Wasn't the title amended and restated declaration?
It does say restated and amended, correct.
Yeah. So that doesn't necessarily unambiguously answer the question, does it?
It does not, but when you look at one of the provisions in the declarations, in the restated declarations, for instance, the now therefore clause, what that clause states, and I'll quote it here, I wrote it in my notes, now therefore the original declaration is replaced by the covenants, servitudes, easements, and restrictions set forth below. So I think says it all, that this is, in fact, a completely new document. It's not something that's appended to the original document. It's just a completely new document that replaces the original document. This isn't, in our opinion, it isn't just wordplay. There's a difference between the two, and there's a difference in terms of the consequences and how you go about enacting the two. The procedures to follow for each are very different. If it's an amendment, if that's truly what it is, there is a procedure that's set forth in the declarations for how you amend a document. The Board of Managers can do it. It says it right in the declarations. And then, of course, there's a standard that has to be met when the Board of Managers goes through the process of amending the declarations, and that specifically is that there has to be no adverse impact. And I'm going to talk about that in just a minute or two when I get to the second argument.
Can this new document stand alone, or are there provisions in the original document that are still in place?
It's our position that there are no provisions in the original document that are in place. It is by its very terms, and I understand Judge Daly's point that the actual title of the document is a restated amendment, but when you look at the document itself, it's completely replacing the original document. And I think if there were to be a buyer of property or there were to be a lender of property who we're looking at, that's the way it has to be interpreted, as a completely new standalone debt document. If it's not an amendment, there's no procedure set forth in the original declarations for how to replace the original documents, or how to replace the original declaration, I say. And in fact, what that means is that the Board of Managers cannot do it at all. It had to be adopted pursuant to at least three statutes, the Colorado Common Ownership Act, referred to as COIOA, the act that replaced, the Condominium Ownership Act, the COA, COA, and the Colorado Nonprofit Corporation Act. And all of those require, at a minimum act, an affirmative, or as a minimum, an affirmative act of all the timeshare owners, as well as the mortgagees. Now, I understand it's been argued, I believe, that that's a extremely expensive and difficult process, because especially here where we're dealing with a timeshare, where you have incremental ownership, as many as four owners for each condominium. So it's a lot of people. We understand that. But that doesn't allow you to simply ignore statutory rights. These are property rights. And in fact, these were properties, timeshares, that were purchased by these people with the existing declarations, potentially, arguably, possibly, relying on those declarations. They potentially financed the purchase and maybe refinanced the purchase of those units, relying on those declarations. In our position, that eight people, or certainly a board of managers consisting of 10 people, do not have the right to simply extinguish or take away those property rights. So, Your Honors, if you consider this a replacement as opposed to an amendment, there's no dispute that, in fact, there was no affirmative vote of the owners, there was no affirmative vote of mortgagees, and that's the end of the analysis. In fact, the restated declarations have to be void. So that's our first argument. Our second argument gets into the issue of, let's say it is an amendment. A lot of people obviously did consider it an amendment. And it's our position that even if this court does consider the document, the restated declarations, as an amendment, the standard which is set forth in the original declarations requiring, or is it setting forth how you amend, have to be met. And in fact, it's our position that it was not met. I think everybody agrees that in order to amend, that Highland was required to comply with that express provision and was required to amend, or it required that any amendment not adversely impact the existing rights of any timeshare owner. And that, of course, is the critical language. Adverse impact. There has to have been no adverse impact in order for this amendment to go through. Now, what the trial court held was after, of course, they did it on a motion to dismiss. Sometimes it was referred to as a motion for directed verdict, but since there's no jury, I think it was a motion to dismiss. And after Aspen put on this case in chief, that Aspen had failed to meet its burden to show that there was a negative impact, and of course the trial court dismissed pursuant to CRC P 41, and that's the reason why we're here. Now, from reviewing the transcript, which is obviously part of the record, as well as the court's written order of dismissal, it's clear that what Judge Moorhead did, what the trial court judge here did, is they relied on the testimony of the two witnesses that Aspen put on, Judge Moorhead held, that essentially they didn't prove, their testimony didn't establish that there was an adverse impact. But what I think that wasn't the only evidence that this judge should have looked at, because I think this is more of a legal argument than a factual argument. Both the original declarations and the restated declarations were in evidence. In fact, I would argue that there was no testimony required beyond just a review of those two documents. In fact, it could be argued, based upon just comparing those two documents, that the effect of the restated declaration was to have an adverse impact.
What adverse impacts are identifiable from, you know, a comparison of the two documents?
I normally don't get questions that segue into the exact next issue that I was going to talk about. That one doesn't. I got lucky. Your Honor, on pages 11 to 18 of our brief, we go through those. And I think it's clear. I'll point out just a few. These were also pointed out in our opening brief. Section 11.1G of the restated declaration allows any common area to be sold with 60% of the total population of the entire project. The original declaration required 60% of each building not 60% of the total, 60% of each building, and 100% of the mortgagees, the lenders. Let's take an example of the clubhouse. The clubhouse is a common area. Marriott, the hotel chain, owns three of the five, or they manage three of the five buildings. Let's say they wanted to sell the clubhouse. Well, they can now do it. They can now do it with 60% of the total population. That was a virtual impossibility under the original declarations, because they would have had to get 60% not only of the three buildings that they control, but the two buildings that they didn't. And so now it makes it much easier. In fact, Marriott has tremendous more control to do what it wants to do, and doing something extremely significant, such as selling the clubhouse, which is obviously an important amenity for a condominium project in Vail, Colorado. Let me give you another example. Section 13.4 of the restated declaration establishes a one-year statute of limitations to challenge future amendments. That's not in the original declaration. By the way, there is a one-year statute of limitations in Kiowa, but it's not to challenge the statute. It's a completely different statute of limitations. But what that would allow Highland to do now, with a change, is to adopt new restrictions, then basically to sit back, lie in wait, don't do anything for that one-year period. Remember, that's one of the arguments that Highland is making here, is that there's no actual controversy because they didn't actually do these things. Well, now they can just sit back and not do anything, and then when they do, they can do something a year and a day later, and they can argue it's too late, the statute of limitations has expired. There's also other sections, again, referenced in our opening brief, 5.1, 6.2, 6.3b, and 12.2. Those all deal with assessments and imposing obligations on the timeshare managers. What they do now is essentially they make Aspen and Highlands a member and therefore liable for those assessments when they were not liable before. It's essentially making Aspen and Highlands the guarantor of all of the individual timeshare owners in that entire building. If one doesn't pay, the privileges, for instance, to use the clubhouse are excluded potentially for everybody in the entire building. Your Honors, those are all, in our opinion, argued in our opening brief, that those are all, first of all, I think they're foreseeable and substantial using the Evergreen standard, although we don't think Evergreen applies, but those are all foreseeable and substantial. That they are all potentially adverse impacts on all of the timeshare owners, certainly in the Aspen condominium building. And we believe that as a result of those adverse impacts, that should have been considered by Judge Moorhead. In fact, he considered extrinsic evidence, but I think that was improper based upon the motion for summary judgment, holding that language was clear and unambiguous. Yes.
Let me ask you, when they made this motion and they pointed to the evidence, did you make an argument that said, look to the documents as well? Did you point out to the trial court that in the documents there were some adverse effects?
I was not the trial court counsel. I was hired for the appeal.
Did trial counsel point that out?
I believe they did, Your Honor. That's in the transcript. There is at least some of the arguments that I have made. I was, by the way, the expert witness who was hired at the lower court level, and that's exactly what my expert opinion, which I think should be in the record because it was designated pursuant to CRCP 26A2. But that is I believe that the argument was made by one of the two trial court attorneys, his name is Doug Turner, and I believe when you read his transcript, you'll see that many of these arguments were in fact made. So the answer to your question, as best as I can recall, Judge Daly, is yes. Does that answer your question?
Do expert witnesses get to represent the parties for which they
well, I certainly, if you remand it, Your Honor, I certainly cannot be the attorney for the for Aspen.
Maybe I'll just stay away from that one.
I believe they can, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And by the way, if you would see my name, so I don't want there to be to hiding that. But I have 40 seconds left. I'd like to reserve at least 40 seconds.
You've got 40 seconds. Make sure you give another second back. Before you begin, counsel, I did not ask you whether or not you had an opportunity to review the oral argument procedures, the written procedures when you came in.
Your Honor, I appeared in front of this court multiple times. I know the procedures.
Okay.
I apologize. So I was a little late from the start of the first argument.
No, I'm fine, thank you.
I've been in front of this court since 1987.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, counsel, Peter Gregory on behalf of Highland PUD Association. With me is my partner, Mark Ryder. This is one of those cases that, in our opinion, calls for a multi-tiered analysis. There are significant disputes between the parties regarding, one, preservation of many of the issues asserted in the opening brief, two, the standard of review to be applied by this court, and three, whether the issues set forth in the opening brief have been adequately raised and argued in this court. The answer brief sets forth those issues with great particularity regarding appellate procedure, and I will try to address many of them. However, we have limited time, so I may not get to everything.
How about addressing the two points that were made by counsel today? One, it was not an amended declaration, and two, in any event, it had an adverse effect on the owners.
Precisely, and I'm going to get to that in just 1 minute. I did want to make a few points regarding the reply brief, and one of those points, Judge Daly, goes precisely to the amendment issue and preservation. With regard to the assertion in the reply brief, and you won't see any reference in the opening brief to preservation as to the amendment issue, and we raise that in the answer brief, and then in the reply they said, yes, we preserve that issue. When you go to the record, what you will see are passing references and use of the word, oh, it was a replacement, and things like that. You will see no legal argument supported by case law before the trial court that this was a whole new declaration rather than an amendment. And that's where the preservation issue comes in with regard to the amendment. Now, addressing, well, two other points, if I might. The reply brief also relies extensively on this court's case of Schussler versus Wolker, both for the standard of review to be applied by this court and the standard of review under CRC P 41. The problem with reliance on that case is that that case dealt with a directed verdict in a jury trial, whereas here the trial court acted as the finder of fact. The standard of review to be applied, both with regard to CRC P 41 dismissal as well as appellate review, is set forth in the Colorado Coffee versus Peaberry case. And that's a critical point that plaintiff repeatedly relies on the wrong standard throughout the case. Now, one other point before I get to the amendment issue, and that is it's important to note the nature of the entities that we're talking about. Highland is essentially an umbrella association. There are no units per se or unit owners per se in Highland. Yes, there are underlying associations that have timeshare units in, but Highland is what under Kiowa, CCIOA, I'll refer to as Kiowa, would be a master association. What we have here is Aspen attempting to use unit owner concepts against Highland, which is more akin to a master association. And that's critical in looking at how this appeal plays out. With regard to the amendment issue, assuming that it was preserved, what do we know? We know that the document was entitled Amended and Restated Declaration. We also know from the record that the declaration essentially was a conglomeration of what had come before. There were three amendments to the original declaration. What you will see in the Amended and Restated Declaration is in essence a restatement of many of the clauses that were contained
in the original declaration and the three amendments, plus some additional amendments. It's not brand new. It's a pull together of what had come before. Now, we disagree with plaintiff that they are not simply engaging in wordplay. Indeed, if we look at how the term amendment is defined, and it's defined in many ways, one of the definitions of amendment is to alter, modify, rephrase, add to, or subtract from. Now, the Supreme Court in the Evergreen versus West case rejected the linguistic argument that we're going to focus on what the words amend and modify really mean, and it looked at the substance of what happened. And the court in Evergreen determined that what had happened there, which was the enactment of covenants which require people to be members of the homeowners association and impose dues, in fact was an amendment, and that it did not unduly burden the members of the community. The ARD, the Amended and Reflected Declaration, was designed to reflect how things had historically operated, both at the master level and in connection with the interaction between the homeowners associations and the master, and to preserve, and this is an important point that the trial court noted, to preserve the flexibility of the master association, which is one of the stated purposes of CAIO. So our position, Judge Daly, is that this is an amendment. It's important to note as well that plaintiff chose a number of changes to identify, but ignores the overall breadth of the ARD and what it was designed to accomplish. Therefore, the ARD constitutes an amendment. Now, with regard to the adverse impact issue, it is important to look at the showing that plaintiff made in the trial court, and to look at that showing under the standard of review set forth in Colorado Coffee. Plaintiff relies, both in their brief and at trial and before this court, on its table of changes, which identified the differences between the old declarations and the amended and restated. However, if you look at the opening brief, Aspen offers no explication through argument or citation to the record as to how these changes affected existing rights of owners. And this is a critical point for the trial court, because what the trial court did was, when it was presented with a motion for summary judgment by the plaintiff saying, "We win, here's our chart of differences," the trial court said, "That's not enough. You need to come forward with evidence showing that any one of these changes has an adverse impact on the existing rights of a current owner." And so that's why the case proceeded to trial. When we look, yes?
Let me ask you, why doesn't, I think, 11.1G, I think he cited to, that allows the common area to be sold based on 60% of the overall population, why doesn't that on its face create an adverse impact?
Because the standard applied by the trial court was different. It was that the plaintiff needed to come in and show that there was an existing impact.
I understand the trial court said the plaintiff needed to show. We don't always accept everything the trial court says and does.
I appreciate it.
For purposes of review, my question was, why isn't the adverse impact evident from the different text?
Because under that theory, Your Honor, any modification of a declaration could always be said to have an adverse impact,
well,
just by the pure fact of change.
Well, not quite. Let's take the current 11.16. That says, gee, you need you know, original, you need the common area to be sold with 60% of the population. Suppose that they amended it to say, wait a minute, now you can sell the common area based on 60% of each building and 100% of the mortgagees. I would think that would have a favorable effect on the owners and mortgagees. And I would think that that would not necessarily, just because it's a modification, the direction is not necessarily adverse.
Well, I don't disagree with that. But the point is that the trial court, and I appreciate that this court doesn't always follow what the trial court said, but the trial court said it's not enough simply to put up the list of changes because you need to show that there was an adverse impact. And then when you get to the testimony, and I think this is...
Well, before we go to the testimony,
yeah.
Tell me why, as I'm looking at the text of this one provision, why it is not an adverse effect or impact on the owners and mortgagees, I guess. Tell me why.
Because,
give me a reason why.
Right, because at that point in time, that was not an issue. So it wasn't adversely affecting an existing right. It's not an adverse effect on some future right. It's an adverse effect on an existing right. And so that was what was missing in what was presented as evidence to the trial court.
What is the standard of review?
On this one?
I mean, sometimes we don't accept what the trial courts say.
Correct.
So what's the standard of review in looking at this?
Okay, the standard of review is set forth, hang on a second, in the Colorado Coffee versus Peaberry case,
right.
I would submit. And here's what the standard is. And that is that if reasonable minds, well, let me back up one step if I might. The standard for dismissal under CRCP 41B1, you'll find this at page 14 of the answer brief, is whether judgment in favor of the defendant is justified on the evidence presented, not whether the plaintiff has presented a prima facie case. Thus, the trial court sitting as the trier of fact determines the facts and renders judgment. Then the standard under Colorado Coffee Bean, Judge Furman, is if reasonable minds could differ over the inferences and conclusions to be drawn from the plaintiff's evidence, then the appellate court cannot disturb the trial court's findings and conclusions. So, despite the fact that the plaintiff put forth before the trial court their chart of differences, there was evidence which the trial court highlighted and relied upon in ruling under Rule 41 from Mr. Meyer of Aspen that he was not aware of any occurrence where an Aspen timeshare owner had been denied any rights complained of in the lawsuit. And he further testified in response, and this is the question he answered. This is a question from my partner. You cannot reference, this is to Mr. Meyer, you cannot reference or testify or otherwise in any way identify any historical occurrence where an Aspen timeshare owner has had a right deprived or adversely impacted. What you contend previously existed and was enjoyed under the original declarations as a result of the ARDs, correct? And Mr. Meyer, the representative of Aspen, answered, that's correct. Similarly, the other witness that testified, Mr. Simmons, as a representative of Aspen, was not able to identify any specific adverse impact. And so what we have is...
So you're saying that they have to be ready to sell the clubhouse before the restriction of the number of votes it takes to be an existing right?
What I'm saying, Your Honor, is slightly different. And that is that in presenting the evidence to the trial court that the plaintiff did, the plaintiff had the opportunity to say more than simply, look at our chart. And what we have here is a situation where plaintiff's own witnesses, when asked specific questions of can you identify the violation of an existing right, answered twice, Mr. Meyer did, and said no. And Mr. Simmons said the same thing. So it comes down to a failure of proof. and the trial court's findings, which have been binding on this court, on that factual issue. There's not really enough time to launch into another argument, so if there are any further questions, we'd ask that the trial court's judgment be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel.
Let's see. 40 seconds.
I'm going to give you 1 second more.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. Your Honor, with respect to the adverse impact issue, we believe it is a de novo standard of review. And Judge Bukmoros, I think that the question you asked the appellee that don't they have to just are you saying that it's non-existing right unless they're basically ready to sell the clubhouse? I think that's exactly what their position is. When they rely on existing, when they argue that there's no legal controversy. In fact, if any buyer or lender of this property were to look at these new declarations, they would see that that is a right which is seriously impacted and may in fact decide not to buy the property because the clubhouse could in fact be sold. This is an existing right that's been impacted.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both, counsel, for your excellent arguments in this case. The case will stand submitted and opinion issued in course. Thank you.